Well, hello everyone, it's Stuart here, and welcome to the latest teleseminar in our Accelerating Growth series. And this seminar is called Relentless Growth: How to Raise the Bar, How to Overcome the Perils of Success, and Deliver More. And this is the eighth of our nine-part series. So thank you as ever for joining me today, and if you are either on the phone or if you're listening to the download, you're really welcome, and as ever, it's great to have you. In the series to date, we've already looked at how we set a growth strategy, how to drive innovation, and even how to grow in turbulent times. But what do you do when your growth starts to plateau? That's the idea behind today's seminar on relentless growth. And we're going to look at three areas over the next 30 minutes or so. First is why nothing fails like success and what to do about it. The second is about building a growth staircase. And the third is just to share with you what I think are emerging as the new rules of business growth. But let's start first area, nothing fails like success. Or put another way, nothing fails like success. And it's almost a mantra I have. And it's the fact that many companies don't fail, don't struggle because they're bad at what they do, but because they are great at what they do. So if you look at Kodak, it's not struggling because it's bad at film processing. It's struggling because it's great at film processing, but the market has moved on. And unfortunately, Kodak hasn't been able to move as quickly. It's the same with Olivetti. It's not struggling because the company's bad at making typewriters, but because the company was brilliant at making typewriters, but couldn't make the move into word processing well enough. And even now today, HMV, the UK music retailer, isn't struggling because it's bad at retailing CDs and records, but because it's great at it and the market has moved on. In all of these instances, customer taste changed, technology changes, the economy changed, and these companies were either unable to anticipate those changes or unable to change as quickly as their markets were. There's an S-curve of success, where you see early growth, then rapid growth, and then as organizations mature, the level of growth starts to plateau. And if it's not addressed, that plateauing will lead to a decline. Now, the ideal time to change is just before the plateau actually happens. The trouble is that most organizations at that point are so convinced of their own success that the management don't usually make the decision to plan the next phase ahead, but they will carry on trying to drive the current success. And it's only, even at the plateau stage, what the management will tend to do is try and reconnect back to the past sources of success and try and get more from them. And it's only when companies get into decline that they are really willing to make the big moves. Unfortunately, in most organizations, it takes at least a couple of years to really drive any serious change. Now, some organizations are able to make the change. Asda in the early 90s was able, after it started to really face problems and decline, it was able to make some changes. It brought in Georgia, Asda, did things with the stores. It really regenerated itself, but it did take it a couple of years or so, but it managed it. Woolworths, on the other hand, the UK kind of general purpose retailer, wasn't able to make these changes, and eventually went into liquidation. So I think you can't wait until the plateau leads to a decline before you make the move and start to think about your next phase of growth. There are some early warning signs I think you need to be aware of that your current source of success could become a source of failure. And they are these. I've got seven of them. One, the rate of sales growth that you see begins to slow down. So you might still be growing, but the rate of growth will be reducing. Second, your market share is flat or maybe even going into decline. So you might still be growing, but you're not growing as quickly as your market, and so your share is falling. Number three, new market entrants are beginning to take share using new technologies and maybe new business models. They are innovating in the market and started to take some share, and that's what happened with Kodak Olivetti and HMV. Number four, less than 25% of your sales are from products and services introduced in the past 3 years. If you're relying exclusively on old products and services, you have a greater chance that you will be overtaken by events and will succumb to a new entrant. Number five, the majority of your new products and services are effectively copies of those of your more innovative rivals. So if what you're doing is just merely trying to copy what others are bringing out, chances are you are falling behind the game. You're not leading your market. When the low-fare airlines first challenged the main airlines in Europe, what BA did and a lot of the other major airlines was they created their own low-fare airline. Trouble was they weren't able to do it as well as the low-fare airlines, and they ended up either disposing of them or selling them in the majority of cases. So if your new products and services are effectively copies of your more innovative rivals, that's another early warning sign that your current success could lead to failure. Number six, customer satisfaction with your quality, with your innovation, and with your brand is either stagnant or in decline. And number seven, you are being increasingly forced to compete on price. If you start to see those seven warning signs in your organization, I think you really need to press harder on driving new sources of growth and thinking about the next phase of your business growth. The temptation is to work harder at what you're already doing to cut costs, reduce investment. And while some of this may be necessary, I think you should be doing other things. And what I see in organizations that are focused on relentless growth are these six things. First is they do actively look for and review these weak signals. They look for signs that things could be slipping. They are slightly paranoid. They are always worried that they are going to get caught out. Number two, they continuously raise the bar. They set themselves new goals and challenges so they don't get caught by the fact that they reach their goal and then ask themselves, what next? Back in 2003, the England rugby team won the World Cup, and they had spent years preparing for that. Trouble was, they didn't have really any sense of what their goals and objectives were beyond winning the World Cup in 2003. And since then, the team has been struggling, really, to regain its position in world rugby. Compare that to, I know it's unfair, but compare that to Tesco, the UK grocer, retailer, set up as one of its strategic objectives, the introduction of retailing services. A couple of years ago, it set itself a higher target for that business, saying we now want to get £1 billion profit from these retailing services, such as banking, mobile phone services, etc. They really raise the bar, and Tesco continuously do that for their business. So that's number two. Number three is to focus on action, to keep experimenting. Not to get bogged down in endless planning, but to get out there and do something. Number four is to intelligently cannibalize your own sales. I think Gillette do a great job at this, of bringing out brand refreshers that, yes, they take away sales from the brands that they already have out there. So if they had the Sensor, Sensor XL, Fusion Power, as they brought out each new brand and sub-brand, it took sales away from the old brands. But it also kept them at the front of the market and made sure the likes of Wilkinson Sword were always kept in a number two position. I call that intelligent cannibalization. And number five, they accelerate innovation. They put increasing effort into driving innovation. And by innovation, I mean new ideas that help them lead their market, not just follow what others are doing. So, first part of today's session is really to say, beware of the fact, even if you're succeeding as a business, beware of the fact that nothing fails like success, and focus on how you can continuously raise the bar and start to think about future phases of growth 2, maybe 3 years or so down the line. So if that's the philosophy you need to do, how do you more practically go about driving growth? In the book I've just recently published, The CEO Strategy Handbook, one of the models I've set out in there, the tools I've set out, is the idea of a growth staircase. And I think there are seven steps to this staircase for most businesses. And I just wanted to spend the next 10 minutes or so just going through those. So at the bottom staircase, the first step on the staircase is the idea of retaining your existing customers and improving your customer retention. It's just far more efficient, it's far more profitable to improve retention of existing customers than it is to go out and attract new customers to fill the hole by those who are no longer buying from you. So yes, you can do that sometimes, as loads of mortgage companies did in the past decade. You can do it through special offers and deals. But customers will only really stay with you if you can provide them with longer-term value and a great ongoing experience. So, for example, you know, Singapore Airlines, quite a premium brand, but creates really loyal customers through its customer service excellence. But it's not just the premium businesses that can do this. McDonald's dominates its market and retains customers by providing an ongoing mix of, you know, an attractive brand, good enough quality on products, price and convenience that its competitors cannot match. And so it's been able to keep customers without having to just have special offers and deals all the time. For any company, the steps to some certain things that you can do to improve retention include, firstly, closer monitoring of customer satisfaction and customer loyalty. So, for example, do you know your customers' level of satisfaction, where they're dissatisfied, and their level of loyalty? Do you know how many customers you've lost over the past 6 or 12 months? Without this kind of information, you're really unable to manage. If you're an organization of any kind of decent size, you're going to be unable to manage retention and loyalty of customers. In my mind, managing satisfaction and retention is just as important, it's more important than managing costs. Yeah, a lot of organizations put a lot more effort into managing costs than they do into managing customer satisfaction and loyalty. Second thing you can do is to enhance the customer experience. And for many of my clients, this is an ongoing focus for management. How can we make the experience better? The key, though, is, do you know which elements of your customer's experience most drive their loyalty? I once did a project with Safeway, the UK grocer that was eventually bought by Morrisons. And they had put a lot of effort into improving the satisfaction of their staff working in their stores in the hope that would deliver better customer service. I did the work with them, and what I found was that customers weren't really shopping at Safeway for the customer service. They wanted the right ranges, and above all, they wanted great value. The business would have been a lot better investing its money not in the HR strategy of improving staff satisfaction necessarily, but in improving the value to the customer. So yes, enhance the customer experience, but make sure that is focused on something that customers truly value. The third thing I think you can do in terms of retention is to start to develop customer relationships and communities. Many retailers have loyalty cards as a way of better understanding how their customers, their shoppers behave, but also giving shoppers rewards for sticking with them. And I have a household product client in the plumbing trade, and it's successfully launched an installers club where it offers its qualified installers higher levels of training, new offers, and involvement in product development. You don't have to be a retailer to start to have the idea of a club. And if you can start to get that group together with social media today, you can also start to build a community. So that's step number one on the growth staircase, improving customer retention. Step two is then to increase the usage rate of your products and services. A common byproduct of improving retention is that your existing customers will buy from you more frequently. But you can also grow usage more directly. So at some point in the 60s probably, some star at Procter & Gamble had the idea of adding to the shampoo bottle the words rinse and repeat. And that effectively doubled the sales of shampoo overnight. You don't need to use the shampoo twice, but everybody now rinses and repeats. Is there an equivalent for your business? You know, the fashion industry is built on the fact that people wear clothes in different seasons, and each season they'll want to buy something new. Swatch has transformed the watch industry by turning the idea of having just one watch into having watches for several different occasions. In what ways can you start to drive usage rates of your products and services? That's number two. Number three is to attract and retain new customers. So that means converting non-users. A lot of technology companies drive growth by getting non-users to buy into products that only kind of more leading-edge customers have previously bought. And the key to successful conversion for them is to have really satisfied, really vocal early adopters who are recommending their products and service to the next level of customers. So converting non-users. You can also find new uses for your products and service or find new customer segments. I've recently been working with Direct Line for Business, so Direct Line Insurance. The same basic capabilities and skills they have been using for personal home insurance, they are now using in small businesses and have set up a small business division for their insurance. They have found new customer segments. And the third way to attract and retain new customers is to take share from competitors. In the past, that might have been about kind of offering special deals. That works today still to some extent, but it has to be sustainable. Shoppers, buyers at all levels in all markets are a lot canny, and certainly cannier, ever more canny. And so they will go from supplier to supplier. It's only where you're really managing the experience, giving ongoing value, that you will get the loyalty and start to attract through word of mouth, referral, recommendations, new customers to your offer. The fourth growth driver on the growth staircase is to offer new products and services. And again, for many of my clients, this is a key driver of growth. And it's also a kind of common source of projects for myself. So if you look at offering new products and services, over the past 10 years, Amazon has gone from just selling books to selling virtually everything. So that in some ways, there is no limit. You want to be able to link it to your own capabilities and what you can actually do. But for your customers, what other products and services would they accept from you? Would they happily buy from you? And what do you have the skills and capabilities to actually deliver effectively? A year or so ago, I worked with a homewares retailer that were quite big in soft furnishings and fabrics and towels and curtains. And we worked out that they had a real opportunity of moving into more of the hardware side of homewares, such as kitchenware. That was a move that they had most of the skills and capabilities already, and certainly customers would find relatively easy. It wasn't a huge shift in mindset for customers to buy kitchenware from that retailer. Compare that with in a previous life, I worked for Boots the Chemist in the UK, and that chain of pharmacy and health and beauty stores, Boots tested and moved into dentistry and well-being services, including things like acupuncture. And what you found there was that customers were a lot more reticent about going from buying some medicines or shampoo or makeup from a retailer to actually using them for dental services. Even with the Boots brand, which is one of huge trust, it was a lot more difficult to get customers to make that shift from that one purchase to the other. And also from Boots' perspective, running dentistry services was a lot different to running its retail business. It didn't necessarily have the capabilities and skills to do that. In the end, the business failed. And a large part of that was just the shift, the jump from where what from its current offer to the future offer was simply too big. But if you can get it right, offering new products and new services to your existing customers is a great way to drive growth. Number five is to enter new geographies and channels. And that, again, is another common driver of growth, geographical expansion and a move into new channels. So at the moment, everybody obviously wants to get, call themselves multi-channel organizations and want to move into internet-based business. But there are also other channels out there that you can exploit. Again, going back to my plumbing products client, they have recently moved. They have previously sold through the merchants, kind of builders merchants and plumbing merchants, and also through specialist bathroom independent retailers. Over the past couple of years, they have also added in through the channel of the large DIY chains, so the likes of B&Q. And so that move into that new channel has given them new routes to market and new growth opportunities. What new channels, what new geographies could you start to move into to drive growth for your business? That is at a higher level on the staircase than some of the others because there tends to be more risk and more investment involved. But it's certainly something you should be considering. Number six is to invest in partnerships and acquisitions. And I think these two areas are really important. Let me just quickly start with acquisitions. Acquisitions gets a bad name, and people say that something like less than a third of acquisitions actually create value. That might be true, but if you look on the other side of it, most high-growth companies find that about somewhere 40 to 50% of their growth tends to come through acquisitions. And if you can become skilled at buying and integrating new organizations into your business, it's a very effective way of driving growth. But there are some rules to this. About 18 months ago, I ran a roundtable meeting with some of the UK's leading strategy directors, and we were talking about acquisitions. And they came up with their rules of effective acquisitions. And let me just see how many they have. I think they have about five or six rules. Let's go through them. The first is to eschew ego-driven acquisitions. And what they're saying there is all acquisitions should be strategy-led. You should know why you are buying an organization. You should have clear hurdle rates, performance management targets, to make sure that you're not buying things for your own personal satisfaction. And it's there to really drive and deliver the objectives of the business. Number two is that successful acquisitions require senior leadership. You can't just have middle managers leading acquisitions. You need your top people making sure that businesses are integrated effectively and that issues are dealt with rapidly. Program offices just can't do that. It needs strong, focused leadership to cut through these issues. Number three, you need to set a hurdle rate that 1 + 1 = 7 or more. There's a balance between stretch and hubris, for sure, in setting goals from acquisitions. But the rules of thumb of this group were that if you really stretch, you might just surprise yourself. But to have a chance of getting to 7, the 1 + 1 = 7, you have to have a roadmap. You need focus, you need clear accountabilities, you're going to need persistence. And that's why things like 100-day plans are really effective. You know, you set yourself a 100-day plan for managing the integration of your new acquisition. The third bit under 1 + 1 = 7 or more is that the lower the price you pay, the more room for maneuver you give yourself in driving the benefits of integration. And what several of these guys did around the table is that they effectively bought the business, they valued the business to them on the basis of their cost savings that they could make. So that any uplift in growth was merely extra because they knew they were going to be able to get the returns on the investment that we're making in the business through cost savings, and that any extra growth would just add to that bottom line. That would help them become 1 + 1 = 7. So that's the third element. Three more. Number four, people issues are critical to the ultimate success. So the newly acquired business will only become effective for the parent when it can operate in line with the culture and management approach of the new group. And that demands leadership from the business that buys the company, but also from the management and leadership team of the acquired company. So getting them on board and helping them to lead through the people issues is absolutely critical. Number five, very small deals and acquisitions only work when they are truly a bolt-on. And that acquiring a small business can be just as time-consuming, just as difficult as acquiring a larger organization. And number six was to beware of bringing in the banks too early. Banks can be great for the sellers. They create a market and they provide distance between the seller and the buyer. But for the buyers, they can be a distraction. And this goes back again to having a clear strategy. So those were six rules coming from some of the UK's top strategy directors in how to make acquisitions work. A recent, alternative to acquisitions that I'm seeing a lot of, and I think we'll talk about this next month in the final session, is the increasing use of partnerships and alliances and joint ventures. So not necessarily acquisitions and equity investments, but just working with complementary organizations to achieve mutual objectives. They give you access to new customers, they give you access to new capabilities, but at a much lower cost. You don't get all of the rewards for sure, but you're not taking all of the risks. Procter & Gamble have gone from being a company that did all of its research and development and product development in-house to now seeking to have 50% of or more of its new products done in collaboration with external organizations. So as I say, we'll talk about this more in the next session, but partnerships, critical, I think, to future ability to grow. So that is the growth staircase. There is one more step. The final step. Let me go through the six first ones. The first one was improve customer retention. The second was to increase usage rates. Number three was to attract and retain new customers. Four, offer new products and services. Five, enter new geographies and channels. Six, invest in partnerships and acquisitions. And then the seventh one was to redefine your business scope. So the ultimate business growth initiative, I guess, is the wholesale redefinition of your business and effectively the creation of a new business. Whitbread, for example, the old brewery, no longer brews beer. Whitbread no longer runs pubs. Whitbread's two big businesses are coffee shops, it owns the Costa brand, and hotels, it owns the Premier Inn brand. It has redefined its business. So whereas you might think of Whitbread and think of beer, it no longer sells beer or is involved in brewing. It has completely redefined its business scope. Now, what that business, the growth staircase does, I think, is that you will probably be working on different levels of the growth staircase. But critically, if you are not attending to the lower steps, the rungs 1, 2, and 3 on retaining customers, getting the customer experience right, attracting new customers, improving usage rates, that has to be your job one for driving growth for your business. But as you start to grow, as you start to climb up that S-curve, and you start to think about how you can avoid getting stuck with the perils of success, you also need to think about the higher levels of growth, the new products and services, the new geographies and channels, acquisitions, and potentially even redefining your business scope. So that is the second part of today, the growth staircase. The final thing I just want to touch on in 5 minutes is what I see as the new rules of growth. In the past, I think the pace of change was perhaps less than it is today. I might be suffering from rose-tinted glasses to a certain extent. But today, the pace of change is turbo-driven. And that idea of nothing fails like success has never been truer. The time period from success to failure is shortening. So I think you need new tools, you need new mindsets to be able to overcome this. And I'm starting to think that there are three key elements to ongoing success. The first are what I call your core commitments. So I don't think you can't avoid making commitments. So anytime you make an investment, you are making a commitment. So in terms of the way you design your organization, the structures you have, the products and services you offer. So McDonald's has made core commitments to its portfolio of franchisees in its brand and its highly efficient supply chain. Sony has made commitments through its research and development activities. And BMW has made commitments through the design of its range of cars and its investment in state-of-the-art manufacturing facilities. These are big investments. These are big commitments. And no organization can afford them. But they come at a price. And the price of these commitments is inertia. They make it harder for you to change your organization. And we've already kind of talked about how companies such as Kodak and Olivetti struggled as their markets were revolutionized by technological changes. And they struggled to adapt quickly enough. And part of the reason for that are the previous investments and commitments they had made. So your business will succeed when the commitments you make are aligned with both your capabilities, your target customers' needs, and the general market conditions. This means that your commitments should be focused on how you're going to be advantaged now, but also over the medium term. It's harder to see what the medium term is, but kind of ways, I think questions you might want to answer include these. Firstly, which of your target customers' needs are unlikely to change over the next, say, 5 to 10 years? What's still going to be important to your customers in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time? Which of your capabilities and competitive advantages are likely to remain relevant then, with that in mind? And which elements of your current business model will stay valid, and which do you think will start to be open to question? And then as you start to ask that question, you start to ask the question about which of your longer-term investments are you really willing to support, and which are starting to look too risky. By trying to look ahead, by trying to understand how your market might evolve and change in the future, you're more likely to make commitments that are relevant to your future business as well as to today's business. So understanding what your core commitments are and not trying to invest and commit beyond that, I think is vital to your ability to change and adapt on an ongoing basis. The second element, I think, in the new rules of growth are the development of options. So I think as a leader of your business, you've got to be developing options continuously. But you also need to assess which options are likely to be the most profitable for you. And that, again, like with your core commitment, is at the intersection of two things: the future needs of your customers and your future capabilities. But in general, in turbulent, in disruptive markets, the more options you have, the more likely it is that your organization will continue to thrive and to prosper. Some questions that I think that you might want to ask yourself are, what customer, market, technological changes can you discern in your market? And what do you think the implications are for your business? What specific opportunities do these changes create for you? And what scope, what changes in your target customers, your products and services, in your geographies and channels, should you start to be developing to reflect both your existing strengths and these emerging opportunities? So if you can really understand where you should be creating options, understand what future opportunities there might be for your business. That gives you the ability, so long as you are managing your existing commitments well, it gives you the ability to be able to refocus your business more quickly. But that leads us on to the third element, I think, in the new rules of growth, the third and final element, and that is speed. So there was a U.S. Civil War general called Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was really successful as a general, and he was asked how he did so well, and his answer was there, I get there firstest with the mostest. And in business, the prize doesn't usually go to the player who simply gets there first. It goes to the player who gets there first, but who gets there firstest with the mostest. You need a great business model as well. So eBay wasn't the first or only online marketplace to be launched, but it was the first that developed a financial and business model that was really successful. To grow at the speed of change, you've got to be able to possess the right mix of strength and flexibility to turn your organization on a dime. Relying on three-year plans and things like that just won't get you there. You've got to be far more agile than that. The capabilities I think you need for really turning your options into success and into relentless growth are really great decision-making, excellence in your ability to implement new products and services. I think you need as simple an organization as you can build. And also, I think you need great partnering skills. And this goes back to the importance of partnership so that you can work with other organizations to achieve shared goals. So this, the idea I see is the new rules of growth, just very quickly, are one is this, it's really the combination of managing your existing, what I call core commitments, building more options for future growth, and thirdly, increasing the speed and the pace of your organization. I don't think there are really any easy answers to the new rules of growth, but spending time with your team to find them, I think, could mean the difference between stagnation and ongoing relentless growth in the future. Finally, I think the other key truth about growth is that there is no end point. If you think there's an end point, that's when you will fail. It's like the story of Sisyphus, in the Greek myth, of the king who spent his life tricking people for his own personal gain. And so the gods said that his punishment in the afterlife was that he would have to roll a rock up a mountain, and as soon as the rock reached the top of the mountain, it would roll back down to the bottom, and he would have to start over again. It's a bit similar with growth. As soon as you reach the mountaintop, to reach your objective, you're going to have to roll your rock to the next peak. The task of growth is Sisyphean. You know, as we've seen today, nothing fails like success. You've got to build and constantly attend to your growth staircase, and you need to be able to create an organization that can play to the new rules of growth. I wish you all the very best in relentlessly growing your business. Thank you ever so much for joining me today. I hope you have a great week, and I look forward to speaking with you again next month. All the best. Bye now.